At Home with Herbs is sponsored by Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, on The Word, 100.7 FM. You experience herbs every day. You see them, you smell them, you eat them. Life would be pretty bland without them. Now, it's time to sit back, relax, and talk about them with Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, who's at home with herbs on The Word today.
On this wonderful day after the 4th of July, I hope you had a chance to see some fireworks last night. Unfortunately, I didn't, but I just love fireworks on the 4th of July. Isn't it just a wonderful thing? I know if you're up close, it can be dangerous, but it's just wonderful to see up in the sky and just a great thing. Of course, for me, as far as I'm concerned, the 4th of July is just a preview to the 6th of July. My birthday is the 6th of July, so although you don't know it, you were actually celebrating my birthday only a day or two early. So, but let's move on to the summer that we have with us. A lovely July day right now with those, as I was driving in, I saw those just tiny little puffy clouds, you know, that are kind of like cotton balls up in the sky. Just gorgeous. And it was just fun to look at that as I was driving. Of course, I was keeping my eyes on the road, but it was still nice to take a peek at the sky every now and then and see that wonderful puffy clouds. Now is the time that we spend more time, certainly on this weekend, picnicking. But more as we come through the year, it's time to eat outdoors a little bit, and a picnic, even if it's just into your backyard, can be a fun thing. And one of the things that's guaranteed to be on the picnic table, of course, is mustard. Now, if you're of my generation, and yes, I am somewhere over 40, you probably grew up dealing with mustard being an amazingly day glow color of yellow. When I grew up, there was only one thing that was called mustard, and it was this tremendously bright yellow. Maybe that's why I never was fond of the color yellow as a child. But now that there are more varieties of mustard on the market, of which I remember when they first started coming out, like the Dijon mustard, when that appeared in the American market, and the Grey Poupon, some of those, it was like, oh my goodness, there's other flavors of this. That's wonderful. Well, I dug a little bit into this, and I found out there's a reason why those have different colors. And let me tell you a little bit about what I learned in digging around about mustard. There are actually three kinds of mustards, or the mustard seed, three plants, where the mustard seed is what we use to make mustard. The one that we're most familiar with, actually, is what's called brown or Indian mustard. All the mustards that I'm referring, we'll talk about right now, are members of the same family as cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, plants like that, sometimes known as the botanical name brassica or the kohl family. So if you've grown cabbages or mustards or even mustard greens or Brussels sprouts, all of those, they have the same basic growing needs in the garden, the same sun, water, and soil requirements. But brown or Indian mustard, that's the one that's most commonly used as commercial mustard and made into commercial mustard that we're familiar with. It's the same plant. It's the same species as is used for mustard greens, although when a plant is grown for mustard greens, I think it's bred more for the leaf production than the seed production. That's something we've talked about before, for instance, with dill. There are some dills that are grown more for the seed production and some actually for more the leaf. And the same is true with fennel, especially fennel, because you've probably seen the fennel bulbs in the store. That's the base of the same plant that, if it was bred slightly differently, would give you the seeds. Well, back to the brown or Indian mustard is the one kind. The second kind I found out was called white or sometimes yellow mustard, although I think it isn't as yellowish as certainly the day glow mustard I remember as a child. The white mustard is the mustard of the Bible. When Christ talked about having faith as the grain of mustard seed, it was the white mustard he was referring to. It used to be called Brassica alba, or now it's called Sinapis alba. But the brown and the white mustard are the two that are used in the majority of the mustard you will find on the grocery store today. The third mustard that exists is called black mustard, or Brassica nigra. This one is apparently harder to harvest. It can't be harvested commercially, and it actually has to be gathered by hand. So it has not been used since World War II in commercial products, although you could, of course, grow it at home and hand harvest it if you wanted to. Well, when Christ talked about mustard as being small as a grain of mustard seed, he wasn't joking. Mustard seeds are indeed very small. 1 ounce of mustard seed is approximately 15,000 seeds. That's very tiny. That's quite a lot of seeds. You certainly wouldn't need that many to grow it at home. If you decided to grow it at home, you'd need to put it in full sun with lots of water. Especially in our climate, you need to treat it more like tomatoes, where you really need to make sure it gets regular watering. If it's going to dry out, you're just not going to get the production you want. Mustard self-sows easily. Well, those little seed heads, when they come up, you get the flowers and then the seed heads. When they come up, those seeds will disperse very easily and will stay dormant for up to perhaps as much as 2 years. So if you've planted mustard in one area, you can be assured of getting it back there in the coming year, probably. So be prepared for that if you're going to grow it. If you do decide to grow it at home, about 10 to 12 plants would be enough to make a batch or two of mustard for using at home. Now, once you get the seeds, whether you gather them from your own garden or you get them from some other source, then they have to be ground. And of course, that's the tough part, because they are tiny, and grinding them by hand would require a mortar and pestle if you had it at home. So most of us, if we've used any kind of mustard, we buy it dry, which you've probably seen in the stores, or prepared. Now, dry mustard, which is just the powdered seed, dry mustard itself has almost no aroma, and it, without liquid, it does not have the chemicals that actually give us the flavor. Once you add cold water, a little reaction takes place, and that's when the heat comes out. That's when you have the hot mustardy flavor coming out. Now, water is sometimes used, but also vinegar or wine. Traditionally, either wine or white wine or a vinegar would be used to mix with the dried mustard powder to make a mustard sauce. And then that sauce that was prepared, that's what we sometimes call prepared mustard. If you see that in a recipe, they're talking about mustard that's not the dry, but it has been added to liquid and is prepared mustard. But many of the prepared mustards, as I said today, still use something like a vinegar or a wine as the liquid. And for that bright day glow color that we're all familiar with, I guess you can tell I don't care much for that. But anyway, turmeric is actually added. Now, that might not be one you're as familiar with. Turmeric is a cousin of ginger. It is a root, commonly used in Indian food, and it imparts a bright yellow color to just about anything it's added to. Actually, turmeric, if I remember correctly, is also used to dye clothing, and the bright saffron-colored, bright yellowish, reddish robes of the monks in India is made from that plant. But anyway, turmeric is sometimes used in your mustard. So when next time you go to the store, take a look, and don't just pick up the one you're familiar with. Look at the other mustards that are there. There's the gray Poupon mustard. Now, gray and Poupon were actually people who were involved in the manufacture of it in France. There's the Dijon mustard, which is named after the area in France it was created in, and of course the other bright yellow mustard, the French's mustard, and some of the others. So keep that in mind and take a look a little more closely next time, because mustard is definitely something to have with you on the picnics. Now, we're just about to go to a break in another minute or two, but when we come back, we're going to have Executive Chef Denise Shivandi from Central Market coming. Denise was with us last week and was talking about Jamaica jerk chicken, which will be in my newsletter, which is the July newsletter, which is just about to come out this weekend. So look for that in your mailbox if you signed up. But we'll be happy to talk with Denise. We'll be talking about foods for picnics, any new trends in picnic food, and fast and easy favorites, and a little bit about food safety. We'll also be answering your calls after that, later on in the show. And if you have questions about herbs or spices, we'll be happy to talk with you then. I think we'll go to the break now. And this is Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl. And if you can call at 1-800-949-5973, we'll be happy to take your calls. Welcome back to At Home with Herbs. I'm Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl. This afternoon, we have a special guest, Executive Chef Denise Shivandi from Central Market. Denise was with us last week. We talked about Jamaica and Jamaica jerk chicken, and I'm looking forward to chatting with her about picnics, picnic food, and any suggestions she has for those of us who'd like to eat al fresco outside. Denise?
Hi, Ann. How are you today?
Hi. Doing all right. Having a good time.
Doing well.
Well, anyway, as I said, we wanted to ask you about what kind of foods do you find most people like to put in their picnic baskets?
Oh, I think you've definitely got to have salads in your picnic basket. Potato salad, pasta salad, maybe a chicken salad or a shrimp salad. I think they all travel well. They're very versatile, something you can eat on the side, put on a sandwich, do a lot with them.
That's true. That's true. In fact, Denise, yesterday I made sort of a German potato salad.
Yes.
Essentially potato salad with bacon bits in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it turned out just right.
Well, wonderful.
Yes.
Now, of course, for those who don't like to do that much of the cooking or would like to save some time, at Central Market we do have lots and lots of what we consider to be our compound salads available. But, of course, you can make some that are fairly easy at home as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just some cooked pasta, even if you've had some pasta for dinner and you have some leftover pasta, very easy to take that with even a pre-made salad dressing, some kind of a vinaigrette, some tomatoes, maybe some feta cheese or onions in there, cucumbers. Little fresh herbs always help everything, I know. Some cilantro or basil would be wonderful in there, and very easy to just toss together with some leftover pasta.
Yes. Sometimes we have to remember that leftovers aren't a problem, but a solution waiting to happen.
Absolutely. I find leftovers to be quite the opportunity to sometimes a little bit of a challenge to get creative with it and make something new.
Yes, yes. And I think your suggestion about pasta is a really great thing, because I'll tell you, I have a tendency to cook too much pasta whenever I cook it, because it starts out small, and I don't think it seems like that's not going to be enough food to feed everybody, so I tend to add a little bit more in, and then when I'm all done, I've got pasta everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. So you need to make a few meals out of it, and making a pasta salad out of some of it's a great option. Great.
Yes, and pasta salad, you can, you know, if you get home and you're just exhausted and you want to throw a couple burgers on the grill or some hot dogs, you've got some pasta salad, you've got something that's going to satisfy everyone.
Well, and a pasta salad could be made, too, with a pesto. Great way to use some herbs if you're growing herbs in the garden. Make up either a cilantro pecan pesto, a traditional basil pesto. I like making a pesto with parsley and walnuts as well, which is really nice because parsley is so inexpensive and works really well in a pesto also, and just some steamed vegetables.
Well, now, some people might be thinking pesto has so commonly been associated with basil that they're not aware of the fact that you can make pesto with something else. So the essential four ingredients of a pesto would be some sort of a nut, like walnuts or pecans or sunflower. See, I know sunflowers have sometimes been used. Fresh green herb like the basil or the parsley.
Right.
And then probably a little bit of cheese, Parmesan or Romano.
Usually a dry, crumbly cheese, like Parmesan. Okay. Asiago works well.
Does it?
Yes.
Oh, I hadn't tried that one. I'll have to keep that in mind. And then a little bit of vegetable oil, olive oil?
Yes, depending on what you're going to do. I like the olive oil, but I think if you're going to use olive oil too, it should be a lighter olive oil, or you can even do a blend. A lot of times I'll take a very neutral based oil, a sunflower oil or a vegetable oil, and then mix in a little bit of the olive oil. Make about three parts of a very neutral oil to one part of the olive oil, and it'll be a nice light olive oil. So it's not quite so heavy and not nearly as expensive either.
Okay, so the nuts give you sort of a body to the whole thing.
Absolutely, and the cheese as well helps.
Yeah, the nuts and the cheese, and then the fresh green herb then gives you the top note of the flavor.
Right.
Okay, so basil is one that you could use, of course, and parsley and cilantro, especially if you're going to be using it as a condiment with Tex-Mex food.
Exactly, and with the cilantro, I think the peanut goes great with that for the nut, and I would always incorporate when making a pesto a little bit of garlic in there. I adore garlic, so.
Well, yes. There are some of us who just love garlic on almost anything. I think I go into that group, yes. Well, tell me, I know you've been in the food industry for some time. Have there been some new trends in the last 4 or 5 years of food that people are liking that they can take out, picnic food, something different? Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that picnic food to me tends to be not nearly as trendy as a lot of other foods. I think it's a little more comfort food, something that can really please the whole family. I think sandwiches are always a great way to go as well, but I like a little bit of a kind of, spur of the moment, make your own sandwich with a big loaf of a crunchy French baguette. Maybe some, a little bit out of the box type of cheeses that you wouldn't necessarily think of for a sandwich. Some brie is great to take along. Maybe a soft spreadable goat cheese, even something with a really rich texture like a gorgonzola dolce. It's got such depth to the cheese itself, and with some good flavored meats on there, some nice quality deli meats, a ham, a prosciutto, some salami. At Central Market we've got a wonderful a truffled ham that just, it adds such a it makes it a little more special on your sandwich. Make some special spreads for it as well. Again, you could use that pesto, mix it up with a little bit of mayonnaise. Makes a wonderful bread spread for a sandwich.
So when you were making a picnic basket, you'd probably be essentially putting in some prepared ingredients. It sounds like, some of the breads and some of the cheeses. And then when you get there, people can put together something that suits them.
Exactly. Especially if you're doing a group of people, it's so hard to know everybody's tastes and preferences before you get there. And if everything's pre-made, it's a little more challenging. And that way, when you just kind of lay out a buffet of a bunch of different ingredients, there's always something appealing to everybody. Several kinds of cheese, several kinds of meat, maybe a couple of different spreads for them to put on there. And they can each custom make their own little sandwich.
Yeah, and make their own comfort food.
Yes.
They're very, very definitely. Okay. What do you? Can you suggest anything that you would consider to be, say, a fast and easy favorite? Something that... because I know when I was a child, my father would sometimes say, let's go to have a picnic. Let's go up into the mountains or whatever. And then suddenly it was like someone had shot off a gun and that we were off and running, and mother had perhaps half an hour to pull the food together.
Right.
So she was pulling it, she had to be pretty fast on her feet at that point. But what, if somebody said, and spur of the moment, let's go out, what would you like to have in the refrigerator that you could pull out for that?
Oh, some fresh vegetables that you could just put with some dip. Is just a great picnic treat. It's light, it's healthy. It can be pretty filling if you put it with a nice dip. Sour cream makes a wonderful dip with just almost any kind of herbs and spices mixed in. You could, almost everybody, every household today probably has some ranch dressing or some kind of other creamy buttermilk dressing in their refrigerator, and you can always kind of jazz that up a little bit. Put a little chipotle pepper in it. Put a little, little fresh herbs in it. Dress it up a little bit. But I think vegetables are extremely important. If you have the opportunity, if you're going to go on a picnic, maybe you could cook out while you're there. Great to have some good sausages available in the freezer or in the refrigerator that you could take with you. Grill up some sausages. Put those on a little bit of bread. It doesn't have to really be a bun. It can be a tortilla rolled up in it. It could be a sandwich bread that you've put it on, or a baguette. The baguettes we talked about before make a wonderful bun for just about any kind of grilled meat.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like something I'd like to be able to pull together very definitely. Well, one thing I'm always concerned about, and I thought I would ask you for some tips for the general public, is food safety. And I don't know. Once when I was a child, my mother did something, and both she and my father got a case of stomach poison, stomach sickness. And I remember being 5 or 6 years old. I was the only one that could stand in the house. And maybe that's why I've always been aware of food safety. And we've talked about this earlier. I know when I said I was using the mantra of keep hot foods hot and cold foods cold, which is pretty true. But we have about a minute left before the break. A couple of suggestions that you could make for people with regard to food safety, which I know is important to you, too.
Well, definitely icing things down. The little blue ice packs are wonderful. Make your own ice pack by I Freeze Ice in Ziploc bags. Works wonderful. Doesn't get everything soggy.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely recommend taking some of the new antibacterial-type gels that they have now, making sure everybody washes their hand. You can even use those to wipe down your serving utensils and things like that as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good thought. Yeah, I was just reading up a little bit before the show about food safety, and they said that actually washing the hands is probably the best way to avoid problems because
Absolutely.
Our hands tend to transfer things from place to place and that's certainly, and especially if you have little ones in the group who don't always think about that. I've seen more than once, a child in a buffet line, and they'll pick up a food and then they'll decide against it and put it back down and pick something else up, and their mother's aghast.
Yeah, but that's the piece you don't want to pick up. I know, I have small children.
Oh, yes, aren't they wonderful? Well, when we come back, Denise, I wanted to talk to you a bit more about that. We're going to talk about deviled eggs, and that's a picnic favorite. See, after the break. Howdy, howdy. I'm here back on At Home with Herbs. I have Chef Denise Shivandi from Central Market with me. We've been talking about picnics and picnic foods. And a little bit later on, we'll be happy to answer your calls if you care to call in a question for Denise or myself. Phone number is 1-800-949-5973. That's 800-949-5973. So now, Denise, like I said before the break, I wanted to get your views on deviled eggs. Now, that's something that always seems to wind up in the buffet lines or the picnic baskets.
Oh, yes.
Do you make deviled eggs over there at Central Market?
Yes, we do. We usually only make them for special occasions, for holiday weekends, or our catering staff does them by order.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a great picnic food, usually a wonderful crowd pleaser.
Oh, yes.
And I think so much of the key to making a great deviled egg, believe it or not, is making a good hard-boiled egg.
Ah, now.
Have you ever seen the hard-boiled eggs? You overcook them and they get green around the yolk. It's just not pretty.
No. Have you been looking in my kitchen lately? Is that
Uh-oh.
Where you...
I know your secret now.
Oh, yes. Hard-boiled eggs.
Yes.
You know, the joke used to be that a young bride, if she was a bad cook, she was so bad she didn't know how to boil an egg.
Right.
Well, you can boil it, but the question is, what's the result going to be?
Can you boil it properly?
Yes. Can you boil it properly? Now, some people have certain, that they hold it over the heat, or they gradually drop it into the water, or they bring it up to room temperature. How do you boil an egg, Denise?
I put my eggs in the cold water. Mm-hmm. And I turn the temperature on the stovetop, turn it on up to high.
Okay.
So I let the eggs warm up with the water in the pot. I bring it up to a boil, and after it's boiled, after it has just begun to boil, I turn the pot off and I leave the eggs in there for about 10 minutes.
Ah, so when it comes up to what I would call a rolling boil,
right.
It's full boil, isn't going to get any hotter,
mm-hmm.
then you turn it off.
Exactly.
Huh. And
so
it,
mine
and
are the, barely boiled, really.
yeah. That. But they don't break on you.
No, I don't usually have a problem with them breaking.
Uh-huh. Okay. So that total process takes, 20 minutes?
Oh, yeah, maximum.
Okay. Because that's another thing I've heard about is don't overcook them, but I'm always concerned about not cooking them enough. And that was so. And now, do you ever get that greenish tinge on the yolk?
You will if you overcook them, and that's why I just bring them up to that boil, and then if you let them just steep in that hot water for 10 minutes, it's hot enough that it's going to get it cooked all the way through,
uh-huh.
but you're not going to overcook them.
Okay. All right. So now you've got the properly cooked egg after 10 minutes. Then do you plunge them into cold water? I've heard that that's one of the best things to do to be able to get the shell off.
Yes. I do plunge them into cold water, and for one thing, it speeds up the whole process of being able to peel them, because they're real hard to peel when they're hot. And also, just for safety's sake, it's always best if we can get that temperature cold just as fast as possible. So I do put them in ice water, let them sit there until they're good and cold, peel them open.
Okay.
And then I cut them across instead of lengthwise. I know a lot of people cut them lengthwise, and you get the oval shape.
Yeah.
I tend to cut them across. You just get... I don't know. They're round. They look smaller, which is just kind of petite and cute.
Mm. Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess being a chef, you would think of doing something a little bit different. Well, one source I took a look at, and I wondered if you had heard of this. One source I said, in order to make sure that the yolk was round and in the proper spot in the egg when you're finished cooking, they recommended letting them stand on the end. On the sharp end, or the sharp end, the more sharper end, overnight, to help the yolks make. Have you ever heard of that one?
Yes, I have. I have heard of that, and that helps center the yolk, and so that it can be a more balanced, properly balanced egg.
So if you want it perfect, I've sometimes boiled eggs and had the yolk way off to the side, where it was just almost peeking out of the white when I was peeling it. Oh, okay. So turning it upside down.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be as simple as the night before taking the dozen eggs in the carton and just turning the carton upside down and putting in that, because you wouldn't need to do anything else.
No.
Okay. All right. Quick and easy tip. Turn it upside down. Okay. So then you get them cooked.
Mm-hmm.
Then it comes to making the deviled egg part.
Right.
And, you know, I looked up, of course, I don't know if you've caught this on from the last show, but I like looking up unusual words and finding out what they're like.
Uh-huh.
I looked up deviled. I don't know if you're, that the term deviled actually comes from 18th century England.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they started calling, because eggs were all, had been boiled and then seasoned for very many, many centuries, as far back as the Romans, where you have recipes for cooked eggs and taking the yolk out and doing something with it. But in the 18th century, they started using the term deviled, relating to using some sort of fiery hot sauces or spices in a food to give it that flavor. And so that's where we also get deviled ham.
Absolutely.
So deviled ham, deviled eggs, meaning it's spicier. And, of course, the most popular spice to add in, certainly in the United States, is mustard, which is what we talked about in the first quarter. Yes, mustard is just about a necessity. I mean, if it's... To me,
yes, for the deviled eggs, absolutely.
If it doesn't have mustard, it's not really a deviled egg. You're doing something else. But once you get past that, there's a number of other things that you can add to it. And I was astonished when I took a look at the different things people have put in deviled eggs. What do you put in deviled eggs?
Well, instead of mayonnaise, I prefer to use an aioli, a little bit of a garlic aioli.
Okay, now.
You know, we did talk about garlic, and I do adore it.
Okay, and the aioli... For those who are not executive chefs,
yes, of course,
is sort of a as I recall, it's a well, you tell us.
It is almost identical to a mayonnaise, except its origins would be in Italy. It's typically made with you do actually use egg, use a few egg yolks, some lemon juice, a little bit of mustard for stabilizing, some raw garlic, and then it has oil emulsified into it, but the main difference, that's where it comes, is it's usually got olive oil in it.
Uh-huh. Okay. So aioli is something like mayonnaise, but with olive oil instead.
Right. And it's usually, I mean, homemade version is just wonderful.
Yes, I could imagine that would taste good. But if someone saw a recipe that called for aioli, they could do a, not quite as perfect, but a substitute with mayonnaise.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Might add a little garlic to it.
Yeah, that would probably be good to give it the extra flavor as far.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you use mayonnaise and I assume mustard.
Yes.
What type of mustard do you like to use in your eggs?
I usually use a Dijon. I usually could use a good strong Dijon in it. And I put a bit of paprika in it.
Okay.
Add a little bit of cayenne.
Aha, for a kick.
Really make sure it's a deviled egg, right?
Oh, yeah, that'll
need a little extra spice.
That'll give it a kick, yes.
And that's it. I keep mine very simple for deviled eggs.
Oh, do you? Ah, okay. So this, I suspect, is one of your personal comfort foods.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can always do something a little different. Would be if you like a little bit of spice and you want to do something different, I think something that would be wonderful in there would be to do some wasabi in it that's used in Japanese food. And wasabi, a green horseradish.
Ah, that would be, yeah, you'd have to put a very little amount.
It wouldn't take much.
Yeah, and any time you're dealing with horseradish, whether it's the wasabi or just the other type, that's strong, yes,
mm-hmm.
Very definitely. Well, you know, we were talking earlier about pesto, and I found also a recipe for pesto deviled eggs.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, that used uses Parmesan cheese, low-fat yogurt. Of course, you could use mayonnaise instead of that. Basil leaves, finely crushed, and garlic powder.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was an interesting different variations. Yes, that is actually for the listeners. That's one of the recipes on the Incredible Edible the IncredibleEgg.org for the Incredible Edible Egg. They have a number of recipes on there that you might find interesting, including if you have young boys, the mystery pirate ships. You can make that, which I saw that and I thought, oh, okay, we know who that's for.
Well, and I think some of it with deviled eggs, especially if you're going to be presenting them to a crowd, is about the presentation. And something you can do that's very simple, just to make them so much more professional looking, is if you have at home a pastry bag, if you do anything with icing, that you might use a pastry bag and a pastry tip, you can do what we call piping in the filling into the egg so that it looks kind of like icing with a little flower tip, and it looks real professional. If you don't have something like that, you can even use a plastic Ziploc bag.
Yes.
Put your filling in there, cut the end off, and you do have kind of a makeshift pastry bag. Now, that'll be a smooth, kind of a smooth dispenser, kind of like a soft-serve ice cream or something. But it'll really give you a nice look when you try to finish off those eggs.
Well, thanks, Denise. I appreciate your time. Denise, Executive Chef, Denise Chavande from Central Market. Hope to have you on the show sometime in the not-too-distant future, Denise.
Thank you, Anne.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Word, 100.7 FM. More of the Herb and Cowgirl, Anne McCormick, on Christian Talk Radio, The Word, 100.7 FM.
This is Anne McCormick. I'm back here with all things herbal. We had a great time with Denise Chavande from Central Market, and now we're moving on to a couple of questions I've received, not over the phone, but via messages, so I thought I would deal with those first. If you have a question, you can call in at 1-800-949-5973. That's 800-949-5973. And you can either come on the air with me, or if you just want to tell the call screener what your question is, she'll pass the word on to me. Well, after the show ended last Saturday, we had a question from a listener. He asked me basically to settle a disagreement between his mother and his wife regarding when it was the proper time to clip flowers off of herbs and when and how you should do it. One of them said that you should cut them off immediately, and the other was that no, that wasn't necessary. Well, the answer is, unfortunately, in this case, it depends. Both of them were right, depending on what you're growing. For perennial plants, such as thyme and oregano, which just recently finished flowering in my garden and in yours too, I expect, there's no reason to cut the flowers off earlier. If you just don't want to bother having them there, you can go ahead and trim them as soon as they show up. They don't harm the plant, nor do they change the flavor of the leaves that are on the plant. When it's finished blooming, you'd tidy it up as you would any other flowering plant, trim it down, and then it will resume growing throughout the coming year. But in the meantime, you've had the pleasure of the flowers on them, which look pretty. I certainly enjoy them. And the bees and butterflies enjoy the nectar that's there. So I always like to leave the flowers on because that encourages the beneficial insects into my garden. When you have beneficial insects in your garden, they're going to be in there also helping to get rid of the not beneficial insects. So if you want to have an organic garden, you want to be bringing the insects in, and that's a good way to do it, is to have the nectar. A lot of herbs are great nectar producers. Thyme and oregano in particular are. So perennials, don't worry about it. You can go ahead and trim them. You know, if you don't like the way they look or if they get ragged, go ahead and trim it. Annuals, it's a different story, because the annuals that you grow in the herbs, you're either growing them for the flower and the seed, or you're growing them for the leaves. For instance, dill and fennel. You grow them either because you're going to be harvesting the leaves and using those, or you're going to harvest the seeds. Now, it's possible also you could just harvest leaf in the earlier part of the year for the dill or the fennel and then just enjoy the seeds afterwards. But whichever one you want the plant to concentrate on growing that. So if you want to have fennel and you want to focus on the leaf production, when you see the flower stalk coming up, cut it off. Not just a deadhead, cut it down a little bit, because if you just trim off the top, it's just going to keep trying to reproduce. After all, with an annual, remember, its life cycle is less than a year, and that means that during a year, it's got to set seed for the next generation. And once it starts, it's triggered towards seed production. This is true especially in basil, which I'll talk about in a minute. You've just got to do something about it by really shocking it to get it back into leaf production. Now, dill and fennel is not as much of a problem if it goes to seed, because people can use and enjoy the seeds. Basil's a different story, because you don't eat the basil seeds, and you really are growing it for the leaves. Cilantro is another one, which by now, if any of you had cilantro, it almost certainly has died out by now. We're into the nearly 100-degree temperatures, and the spring cilantro will have died, and you'll need to plant it again in the fall. But let's get back to basil. When you see the flower heads starting to show on the top, they're a little kind of a square formation is what it looks like if you're looking at it from the top, and it's starting to put up a little inflorescence, a little stalk with all the tiny flowers on it. You want to get that off of there, but you don't want to deadhead. You don't want to simply get out there and clip just the flower part off. That's perfect for ornamental plants. That's what you've been trained to do with your chrysanthemums, with your azaleas, with plants. Marigolds, for instance, you clip off the dead heads, and then you'll get new flowers coming up because you want to encourage more flowers. So you're preventing the seeds from being formed, so it puts up new flowers. Well, in the case of basil, that's not what you want. You want the leaves. So you take your scissors and you cut at least 3 to 4 nodes down on the stalk when you cut off the seed head from basil. So you're actually doing a partial harvest. You cut it down. You can cut a basil plant as much as half, even some cases to a third if it's a healthy plant, and it will come back and resume growing. And when it grows, it will actually be bushier, and you will get more basil throughout the entire year. So it's actually to your advantage to clip off the tip. Cut it much further down. So that's the difference between your flowers on a perennial plant, perennial herbs, and your flowers on an annual. Flowers on an annual, because that's going to focus on the seed, that's not going to give you what you want, so you really want to be cutting back. On the perennial, it's not really as much of a problem. You're just more concerned with tidiness in your garden. And that actually brings me to the next question I had from another listener. She was telling me that her yarrow has finished blooming, as has yarrow in my backyard. It's finished blooming, and it's time to clip those flowers off. And she was wondering, should you just clip off the top or clip much further down? In the case of yarrow, you want to clip all the way down, because yarrow sends up a very strong stalk. If you take a close look, you'll see a lot of fern-like leaves down at the bottom that maybe grow, oh, maybe 8 to 12 inches high. And then there's the flower stalk that comes way up. In my garden, it gets up about, oh, 2.5 to 3 feet. So you want to clip that all the way down. In fact, this is one thing where you can use a weed whacker. You can just cut it right across and clip the leaves as well, and it will grow back. And it will look lush and green again, and you'll have the leaves then as a ground cover through the remainder of the year, and then you'll get the new plants into the coming year. So those are a couple of questions I had. If you had a question, we've only got a few more minutes, but if you have a question, call at 1-800-949-5973. In the remaining few minutes that we have, I wanted to get back to our topic about picnics, and one of the things that always seems to show up on a picnic are the bugs, the insects, and the mosquitoes in particular. Just a quick look, a couple of quick notes to tell you. Something with citronella oil is good. That is not the citronella geranium, however. Citronella oil comes from a relative of lemongrass. Those of you who grow herbs or grow lemongrass, which is an Asian cooking herb, the citronella comes from a relative of that. Another plant that's good is tansy. Tansy tends to repel flies. The downside is that it's the tansy juice that repels the flies. So you have to actually crush the plant in order to release that. And basil. Surprise, surprise, but I looked into this at one time and found out that basil does indeed can be used as a mosquito repellent. But again, it's the juice of the basil and not simply the basil leaves around. Well, we're just about out of time, and I wanted to tell you I'm very excited. Next week, we are going to have a special guest from Celestial Seasonings, a master blender. Our theme next week is going to be Southern summer beverages. We're going to talk about iced teas, lemonades, things like that. And our guest from Celestial Seasonings will tell us about how he pulls together herbs to make an interesting herbal blend. So stay with us next time when we go over that. July newsletter will be going out very soon. Look for it in your mailbox. My website, unfortunately, is down. Hopefully in the next few days it'll be back up, and then you can sign up for the website for the newsletter. I'm very sorry to say it's way down. I cannot believe I haven't had this happen in 10 years. But I'm just ready to finish up. I hope you have a great week. Our sound engineer was Matt Swinney. Our call screener was Janice Bunting. And this is Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, wishing you a happy urban.
If you want to contact Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, you can send Ann an email to ann@ann-mccormick.com or go to her website at www.ann-mccormick.com. And remember to tune in from 3 to 4 Saturday afternoons to join Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, for At Home with Herbs on Christian Talk Radio, The Word, 100.7 FM. At Home with Herbs has been sponsored by Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl. You can listen to At Home with Herbs every Saturday afternoon at 3 on Christian Talk Radio, The Word, 100.7 FM.